Nightside with Dan Ray, the voice of reason.
I'm the voice of reason because I honestly do believe reasonable people can disagree reasonably.
The smartest guy on radio.
So if you're looking for a live show that is local and also gets into 38 states, you found it. It's Nightside.
Call 617-254-1030 or 888-929-1030.
I'm the voice of reason. Here in New England and in all 38 states where we are heard on North America's back porch.
WBZ News Radio 1030.
Well, good evening. It has been quite a day here in Boston, Massachusetts. Good evening. My name is Dan Ray, the voice of reason, the host of Nightside. Rob Brooks is behind the glass. We have some students with us in studio tonight from the West End House here in Alston. All very smart, intelligent, attractive, beaming-faced students, some of whom actually might want to be journalists. So I want to welcome them, as well as Ashley Galati of the West End House and Kevin Honan, former member of the Great and General Court. They are with the Brian Honan Fellowship, which is named in honor of Kevin's brother, the late Brian Honan, also a former member, elected official here in Boston, a Boston City Councilor. But the issue of the day today is the Whitey Bulger verdict. The verdict came in today, and Whitey Bulger was found guilty on many, many counts. We'll get into some of the specifics with some lawyers later, but we are privileged to have in studio a member of the jury. He will be identified by his first name. It's my decision not to use his last name. He will has been interviewed by WBZ-TV and will be on the 11 o'clock news tonight on Channel 4. Scott, welcome to Nightside.
Thank you very much.
Going to move you right up to that microphone. So you were one of the 12 who sat through these lengthy deliberations.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to keep you long because it's been a very long day for you, and I appreciate you coming in. Scott, what was it like in that jury room? Was there anyone in that jury who actually felt Whitey Bulger was not guilty of at least some serious crime? Was there anyone in that room who thought that he should walk free?
No, I would definitely say that, but it seemed like some of the major crimes were contested, or there was some real turmoil about how to determine that he was guilty.
Well, there was the one no finding. There were 19 murders which were alleged, and they were all part of a conspiracy, a racketeering conspiracy. You know this better than I do. Seven were not proved.
Angeli? Ones, the original early ones.
Yes, were not proved. 11 were proved. One was a no finding, and that was one of the probably better known murders, the Deborah Davis murder. Bulger was accused of having actually strangled her. As a matter of fact, you heard Fleming on the witness stand say that Bulger strangled Deborah Davis. How come there was no finding on that particular murder?
Well, I was one of the jurors that said that, you know, I felt he was guilty, and other people said that he wasn't of that crime. So since there was conflicting, you know, voting on that, we had to have a no finding.
Was there a significant split, or was it just a couple of holdouts on that crime? When I say significant split, meaning 7-5, 6-6, or was it just one or two who were not convinced?
Maybe about five.
So it was fairly close. It was a fairly close vote. It wasn't where there was a holdout. If there were five who were not convinced of it, that really was a hung jury in the classic sense.
Well, I guess the way that people put it was that it seemed like there wasn't enough evidence to convict him of it, but other people felt there was.
Well, most of the evidence on that case, on that allegation, I believe, was Fleming's eyewitness testimony.
Yes, and people kept saying that you can't believe what he says. It became the government gave people, you know, a proffer that said that, you know, if you give substantial testimony, then, you know, they're going to lighten your sentence. And to me, that wasn't a factor. You know, like it seemed to me that two bodies buried in a very similar place right next to where he lived was pretty damning. You know, they show a picture of it. Here's the bridge. His like condominium building is in sight of where the two bodies were buried. And we already found the person guilty for a body buried there next to her.
And pretty strong circumstantial evidence.
I thought so. Mm-hmm. But when I said that, I was said, well, what if somebody found a body in your neighborhood? Did you do it? You know, because it's buried close to where you live. And I'm like, how about two bodies? You know, and you're part of a gang that knew to both of these people very well.
I was there the morning that they dug those bodies up, by the way, during my my tenure as a TV reporter. So I'm very familiar with exactly what you're describing. What was the general impression amongst the jurors sitting in the same room with Whitey Bulger all those days? I mean, you folks have now been between the trial and the deliberations. It's over 2 months. Was there any impression that you had of this guy? I mean, he's an 83-year-old man, obviously well past his prime in many respects.
Well, a lot of the jurors seemed to think he was in pretty good shape for his age. But there wasn't a lot you could draw from since he didn't actually testify or say anything except maybe some swear words once or twice to Kevin Weeks.
And Fleming.
Yes.
Do you think Bulger would have helped his cause if he had taken the witness stand?
To me, absolutely, because the defense didn't offer any kind of an explanation for why certain things happened. They just said, you know, you can't, there's no evidence, so how do you find him guilty? You know, like, it's kind of like, you know, we don't have to say anything in our defense.
Well, oftentimes when a client, when the government hasn't made the case against a client, oftentimes the defense will rest without putting the client on the witness stand because in the mind of the defense lawyer, the government hasn't made the case. Why give the government any help in making their case? I assume that that was not what you folks felt at this point.
Well, I think the defense is, you know, the way that they put up a billboard and said how you should, like, take the evidence. And they played it that way, and that's what caused the hung jury for those days. Like, some people actually believed the government was more responsible for the murders than Bulger because of the FBI involvement. And I just felt, as the defense did, I mean the prosecution, that this is not really the case. The case is that Bulger was involved in committing murders, and the government has nothing to do with that. You know, if somebody kills somebody, it's them doing it, not the government.
Was there anyone in the jury pool or in that jury room who was inclined to acquitting Bulger?
Well, it seemed like almost too much consideration to find him not guilty on something, when it seemed easy to make a guilty on almost every charge that there was. But it seemed like it was very hard for everybody to agree that he was guilty. Like, people were looking for a reason not to say he was guilty. And there definitely was fear in the jury deliberation room. It looked like some people were bright red, and somebody said that they could jump out the window. They were under so much stress, and people were taking Advils.
Fear of what?
I asked that. I said, what? But, you know, the responses were very short. There wasn't discussion, as you would think. It seemed like people could have an opinion without actually explaining it fully. And I said, no, you have to, if we have to come to an agreement, either proven or not proven, we have to know what people think so that we can make a decision together.
Did everyone in the jury participate, or were there people who sat back and listened more than participated?
Well, everybody participated in their own way. Maybe I was one of the more vocal people. Like, I basically came right out in the beginning that I felt he was guilty, and I was told, no way. You know, why would you say that? And I'm like, well, the trial's over. Like, we're here to decide this.
So there were jurors who said to you, he's not guilty?
Yes. Yeah, it was amazing. Like, it was like they said that you were acting emotional. Like, why would you say that? Like, that hasn't been decided. I says, well, it's decided to me. I watched the whole thing. It's time to make a decision. Like, I looked at the sheet with all the charges, and it's like, yeah, it's true.
Were they just not ready for a decision? Or do you think that they actually had doubts about the government's case?
Maybe they didn't even know how to make the decision. You're not really prepared for this in everyday life. If you're, like, say if you were an electrician, you're a very cautious person because of the type of work you do.
Sure.
So, like, you might be very cautious about the way you make a decision. But other people might be a little bit more you know, bold about the way they handle things, so they would be able to make those inferences.
How many of the jury members were at least aware of who Whitey Bulger was? I realize that each of you had to be able to come to qualify for the jury. You had to be able to come with an open mind and consider the evidence. I understand that. Were there any members of that jury who had no clue as to who Whitey Bulger was before this trial began?
Well, I would have to put myself in that category. I think other people seem to definitely know more than me. I didn't really pay attention to those facts. I know there was one juror that said before he was told not to look at stuff on the internet, went and looked at everything, but he wasn't part of the deliberation.
He was one of the alternates?
Yes.
One of the alternates.
Yes.
And you're convinced that all the jury members who decided Whitey Bulger's fate complied with the judge's instructions?
It seemed like there was no obvious violations.
Okay. Scott, this has to be something that you remember for the rest of your lifetime.
Well, I hope it's something good in some way.
Well, you certainly provided a service, and I appreciate you having taken the time to come in tonight. I know it's been the end of a long day. You're unemployed at this point, right?
Yes, I am. And I wish I could find some work in the biotech field. And I think sometimes if you say that you worked on a case like this, people think that you're just straight out lying to them. And I was told, actually, that I wasn't doing jury service, that I was actually arrested and going to court because I was arrested by some people.
Scott, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you leave your phone number with me. What sort of work do you do in the biochemical, you
said? Well, I'm a manufacturing technician.
In biochemistry?
Yeah, like, you know, we made a hemoglobin blood substitute. It works very well, although it's only been approved for veterinary use in the U.S.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you, we're going to go to a commercial break here, but I'm going to thank you for coming in. Secondarily, I will take your phone number, and if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you who have a job to offer, well, I will put them in touch with you, but I will screen them for you, I promise.
Okay? Oh, that would be really nice.
Scott, appreciate it very much. You seem like quite a gentleman. Thank you.
And thank you so much for the whole opportunity to talk with you, sir.
Thank you very much. Scott, one of the jurors, stay there for 1 second. Scott, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back. We're going to be talking with Lana Jones, and we're also going to be talking with Chris Nylon right after this break.
Nightside with Dan Ray. Call 617-254-1030 or 888-929-1030. The News Watch never stops. WBZ News Radio 1030.
My thanks to Scott, who was the juror who sat in the second seat. Lana Jones of WBZ Radio is here, and she remembers Scott as a juror.
Scott came in every day in a shirt and tie, and he sat leaning forward, listening to every word of that testimony. And I commented on him leaning forward every day. He says, well, my chair was missing a spring, and I was very uncomfortable. But he did pay attention. They all did. They were just riveted. It was something.
Despite the verdict today, there are still a couple of open questions. And one of those questions deals with a request by Whitey Bulger's attorneys that Whitey Bulger could keep a Stanley Cup ring. Joining us now from Montreal is a friend of mine, a man who I represented during his National Hockey League career and someone who I've known for many, many years, my friend Chris Nylon. Chris Nylon, welcome to Nightside.
Thanks, Dan. How are you, pal?
I'm doing great. Your name has been dragged into this. Some pictures of you have been displayed. To set the record straight, I think everybody should understand that your former wife, Karen Stanley, who is still a great friend of both yours and mine, and a great woman and a mother, a great mom to your three children, was the daughter of Teresa Stanley, who for many, many years dated Whitey Bulger.
Yes, exactly.
All right. And there has been a question that has been raised today about a Stanley Cup ring that Whitey Bulger asked through his attorneys to be able to keep. And I know that there's been some questions about whether or not how Whitey Bulger came into possession of a Stanley Cup ring. And I would like to have you clarify it for my audience, as you did earlier today. You remember the 1985-1986 Stanley Cup champions. What did you do with your Stanley Cup ring?
Well, what I did with my Stanley Cup ring is I gave it to my dad. As soon as I was given that ring, I reached out to my dad, and I came to Boston, and I told him I wanted him to have the ring because of all the things he did for me in my life and helped me to achieve the dream of one day playing in the National Hockey League. And he was a big force in that, and so was my mom. I had a ring made for my mother. I had one made for Teresa Stanley, my mother-in-law, and I also had one made for Karen. Now,
those rings, Chris, were made at your expense through a jeweler who you must have known, I assume, in Montreal.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And your mom still has her Stanley Cup ring.
Yeah, and Teresa, God rest her soul, she passed away last year, lung cancer. And she left her Stanley Cup ring I gave to one of my daughters.
Okay, so...
And there were no other rings I had made. There were no other rings I knew of. All I can think is that maybe Jim had one made. He was a Canadiens fan. I know that. I know he loved coming to the games. I know he loved watching the games. I will tell you, again, I married Karen. I didn't marry Jim Bulger, but he was part of that family. And what I will say is he never crossed me. He was always good to me. I know he's done some terrible things to people. The business he was in, and some of those people, the business they were in. Do I agree with it? No, but he was a friend. He was always good to me. And again, what kind of friend am I if I, throw him under the bus now? I don't agree with what he did, but he's paying for what, for the crimes he committed. And it was, they caught up with him finally. It didn't look like they were gonna. They did, and now it's his time to pay. He's always been a friend to me. He's been good to me, and that's all I can say about that. As far as the ring, again, I'll just tell you, and you know me, I'm not a liar, Dan. I'm a truthful person. I lay it out there, and all I can think is that he had a ring made for himself because I know he really liked coming up here and watching hockey games.
The other thing that I think, just for clarification and so that we have the record straight, Chris, is that you actually were given a second ring, which you have, by your general manager at the time, once he heard that you had given your ring to your dad, correct?
Exactly. Serge Savard, the general manager at the time, heard that I gave my ring to my dad, and the following season, after I was traded to the New York Rangers, I came back to do my golf tournament for Children's Hospital here in Montreal. And he had called me at the hotel and asked me to come and see him. And he had another ring for me, which I still have. So that ring didn't go anywhere. So as far as a Stanley Cup ring, where Jim Bulger got it, he didn't get it from me. And all I can think is he might have another friend in the NHL. I don't know. But
well,
he didn't get it from me.
Well, the thing that's important, Chris, is to set the record straight. And by the way, people who don't know you do not know what you have overcome. You overcame a lot as a professional hockey player. We went through that for many years. You worked very, very hard and had a great career of 13 seasons, and then had some problems that you've dealt with. Right now, you're doing a sports talk show in Montreal.
Off the Cuff. Yeah, I do it from 1 to 3 every day. Sports radio. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I'm happy to be back here in Montreal. It's a great city. The people are great. Life is good again.
And you also you speak a lot on the issue of bullying to kids in schools.
Exactly. I go around. I saw the anti-bullying program here in the schools. I had a chance to come home and speak down in Rockland last school year, which was fun. I've been down in New England a little bit, but I do most of it up here. It's a lot of fun. Kids, it's an empowering session I have with them, and it's also informative. And the kids are really great. I have fun doing it. It's a way for me to be able to give back to a community that really has done nothing but support me from the day I I landed here in Montreal back in 1979, my first year of training camp, and the people have been wonderful to me. Yeah, they've always supported me, and I feel right at home here.
And you also, for those who might be interested, have been able to travel on several occasions to Afghanistan in support of NATO forces, specifically Canadian troops.
Yeah, I've gone 5 times now. I've been 4 times to Kandahar. I went last year to Kabul. It was just a wonderful time. It's more or less a life-changing experience for anybody who's ever had the opportunity to go there. Every person I've went with, former NHL players, NFL players, CFL players, they've all really been touched deeply by just the experience of going there and seeing what these young kids, American boys, Canadian boys, do on a daily basis to try and, keep us secure back home. And it's an incredible experience. I'm going again, I believe, in October. It's the last trip, I believe, they're going to have until that mission is over. So I'm looking forward to that one more time going. And it's a whole lot of fun. It's a pretty amazing experience to go over there and see what when you see these young American kids who on a daily basis put themselves in harm's way, again, to give us the freedoms that we have back home here. Honestly, I don't think enough people realize it and appreciate it, and tell you the truth. It's a shame, but when you get the opportunity to go there and see it firsthand, it's even more real than I had a dad that was in the military who, dad was a Green Beret. He was in the reserves. He trained as a jungle expert. He trained other guys to go off to war, and my dad was a hero in my life, and for me to get the opportunity to go over here now and see these guys, and if I can just by going over there and sitting down and having lunch with one of them, it makes a whole lot of difference. I didn't think it did when I first went over. I said, what difference am I going to make when I come over there? But the troops really appreciate it. They love seeing people come from home and really seeing what they do on a daily basis. So, I wouldn't change it for the world. It was a great experience, and I'm looking forward to going again, Dan.
Well, Chris Nyland, thanks for, first of all, coming on the show. Thanks for the example that you have given to a lot of other people who are dealing with addiction issues. And thanks for clarifying the question of the ring. And I'm proud to call you my friend.
Well, you are my friend. I got to tell you, I just go way back to the first time you represented me. And you told me, Chris, I'll be your friend long after hockey's over. And there was never a truer word said out of your mouth, because that is something that has our friendship has withstood the test of time for sure. I've had opportunities. I have the agents that came after me during my career to try and get me to jump ship and go with them. And there's something to say about loyalty, Dan. You've been loyal to me. I've been loyal to you, and you're a good friend, and I appreciate it. You got a great show. Mom listens to you every night, Mom and Dad. So hopefully they're listening tonight. I'm sure they are. So,
right back.
It'll be a surprise. I didn't get a chance to call them.
I should have called it for you. Right back at you, Chris. Please say hi to Jamie and the dogs. And anytime you want me on your show, you'll let me know, okay?
Dan Wright, thanks, buddy.
Thanks, pal. Chris Nyland, ladies and gentlemen, clarifying a question about the Stanley Cup ring. Going to be back with Lana Jones. Your phone calls as well, 617-254-1030, 888-WBZ-1030. Open up those lines as well. Your reaction to the Belger verdict. Nightside coming right back.
When news breaks, the choice is clear. WBZ News Radio 1030. The news watch never stops.
Trying to touch as many bases as we can here on this Monday night edition of Nightside. We do want to get your reaction to the verdict today. We spoke with one of the jurors in studio during the first segment. His first name is Scott, juror number two. With us in studio now is Lana Jones, who certainly knew Scott from having... Lana was one of the, I think, is it 15 reporters who sat in
the entire
trial? There
were 15 of us that sat through the entire trial. We didn't know him. I mean, somebody...
No, but you didn't know him, but you,
at every
you recognized him tonight when you walked in the studio. Joining us also... is Harry Mannion, one of Boston's great. Also, we had just spoke with Chris Nyland to clear up the Stanley Cup ring issue, which is really not a particularly important issue, but one which I think was important to clear up. Harry Mannion, attorney Harry Mannion, joins us. Harry, how are you tonight? We have Harry potted up in there, Rob. Harry, you there? If he's not, we'll reconnect with Harry Mannion. Still there? Oh, no, Rob, just give me a quick look. Not there. Okay, Harry, we'll come back with us in a minute. Lanny, you sat in there for the entirety of this trial. I forget how many days. Was it 35 days?
It was 35 days of testimony, 2 days of argument, openings and closings, mm-hmm. and 5 days of deliberation.
Were you surprised the jury was out as long as it was?
No, I wasn't. They had 63 decisions to make. They had 32 counts, and in that big count, too, there were those 33 racketeering charges. And it sounds to me like they went through every single one and ended it meticulously.
Scott, the juror, said that he thinks Bulger should have gotten on the witness stand. Now, he had a different perspective than you. Obviously, you're sitting amongst the reporters. Did you ever think, I understand that Jay Carney was telling reporters up until the day before that Whitey would take the stand.
We all thought he would, and taking Jay for his word on that. But you know what, Dan? I don't see how he could have done himself one lick of good in this trial. What he wanted to argue had nothing to do with the charges. He wanted to argue, I'm not a rat. Well, there's nothing.
Well, he wanted to argue. He also wanted to argue immunity.
He wanted to argue immunity, but that was out. That was out. And Jay had said, with immunity out, he just couldn't take the stand.
And that I assume is going to be the basis of any significant appeal.
That's what he said today. Sure. Yeah.
Although my sense is that there's legality and practicality. That even though an appellate court judge might be inclined to look at it legally, I wonder if some practicality issue might get involved here, because why would the government want to give him another bite at the apple? Why would appeals judges allow the circus? The circus is about to leave town, in other words.
Well, the appeals court sees an issue there. I mean, they're certainly going to have to take it up. You remember those 98 hearings. Judge Wolf went on, 10 months or something? He wrote a 660-page opinion that gave some credibility to Stephen Fleming's argument for immunity. And that's what Carney and Hank Brennan kept coming back to.
I sat in on the hearings conducted by Judge Wolf, and if it had not been for Judge Wolf and the very specific and time that he took to not only make these witnesses, and Judge Wolf was criticized by Fred Wyshek, the prosecutor. He was criticized by some of the defense attorneys as well. But if Judge Wolf had not been the great judge that he was, I think without Judge Wolf's hearings, I don't know that all of this stuff ever would have come out. I mean, he opened up a can of worms that I think a lot of people in the federal government would prefer never to have been opened.
Well, Colonel Tom Foley told me today, he's a retired state police colonel who was one of the original people on the Whitey Bulger trail. And he said, at some point during those Wolf hearings, it was Martirano who said, when they learned that Fleming had been a rat for the FBI, and Martirano starts cooperating with the government, then it was all over. Then they began to make their case. Before that, he said they really had nothing.
Right. And they would not have had it if Judge Wolf had not forced the testimony to come forward.
Absolutely.
In the way in which he forced it to come forward. And he was oftentimes criticized by Wyshek, who was the lead prosecutor and to this day was the lead prosecutor. I don't know that Wyshek really appreciated how thorough, and Judge Wolf is the most thorough federal judge that I've ever had the privilege of sitting in his court. And I think that without Judge Wolf's work and months of work, that what resulted today might not have resulted. And I also remember that the Boston Globe wrote a scathing editorial about Judge Wolf's decision. And I hope the editorial writers at the Boston Globe will review that editorial and perhaps come back with a correction.
Well, I wonder. But, from opening argument clear through this case, 8 weeks of testimony here, Fred Wyshek and Brian Kelly and Zach Hafer had to acknowledge with half or more of the witnesses this FBI corruption. They had to acknowledge in the course of their direct and their cross-examinations at the end there how much corruption existed during those years when Whitey Bulger and Stephen Fleming were operating this incredible
criminal enterprise. But it also predated Whitey Bulger. It goes back to Paul Rico and Dennis Condon, who trained John Conley.
Yeah, yeah.
Who basically tipped off John Conley to Frank Salemi's whereabouts in New York City, which was Conley's ticket to come back to the Boston office without that information. And they used as their informant Barboza, who put Lamoni and Salvati and Tamelio and Greco in prison. And then when Bulger gets out of prison, he hooks up with his partner, Fleming, who had been an informant, and Fleming's brother, Vincent Fleming, had been an informant. This is a continuum that went from 1965 to 1995. And the federal government has yet, the people who I think were most relieved when Bulger didn't get on the witness stand, retired FBI agents.
Or dead.
Well, if they're dead, they don't regret it, but right. Their families might. My guest is Alana Jones. We will get squared away, I'm sure, with Harry Mannion. We'll also hopefully be talking with Attorney Tony Cardinale. But I want to hear from you. Were you surprised by the verdict today? You've now heard from one of the jurors just a few hours after that verdict was rendered, Scott, and I withheld his last name. You will see him tonight on WBZ TV, Channel 4, at 11 o'clock. I know they may use him. I think they're going to hold his interview until 11 o'clock. Maybe we'll be talking with Lisa Hughes about that at some point. I'd love to hear from you. Your reaction to this verdict. Was it anticlimactic? Did you ever have a thought or a belief that Whitey Bulger would somehow walk away from this? I think I got a sense from Scott, the juror, as to how thorough this deliberation was, if we didn't know it already. Clearly, he took it very, very seriously. Want to be in the show? 617-254-1030. Nightside continues dissecting the Bulger verdicts today. If you've just got out of work and just flipped on your radio, guilty on 11 counts of murder, not proven, which is the equivalent of not guilty, on 7 counts of murder and 1 count of murder, Deborah Davis, no finding, as well as all sorts of gun and money and laundering charges and racketeering. Back on Nightside, your phone calls right after this.
News updates all day. Dan Ray and Nightside at night. The News Watch never stops. WBZ News Radio 1030.
Before we get to phone calls, I just want to say thank you to Lana Jones. Lana, who covered the Bulger trial from stem to stern, as they say. You hope you get a couple of days off now, Lana.
I should. I've worked a couple of days that I was supposed to have off because I couldn't leave.
Yeah.
Once it got you can't walk away from this.
Pretty compelling stuff.
Oh, my goodness. And I've been telling people there was one boring day. The defense was cross-examining somebody on some forensic evidence, and the witness wasn't budging. And it happened to be the day that Aaron Hernandez was arrested. that worked out just fine. But every single day, Dan, I mean, the testimony was shocking.
Did you ever make eye contact with Whitey?
No. I always say Whitey kind of disappeared into the room. He'd walk in every day, maybe acknowledge his brother, and he'd sit down. And except for a couple of times,
his brother Jackie, Billy Jack, never showed up.
Sorry, yeah.
No. I just wanted to clarify which brother.
He just disappeared. He's a small man, and you know, very pale, white. He just sort of disappeared into the room. And that was it.
All right, Lana Jones, I'll let you disappear here. I appreciate so much you taking the time tonight. Thanks very much, Lana Jones. You've heard her on WBZ Radio. Now you've heard her on Nightside. Thanks, Lana. Get some rest. We're going to get to phone calls, and our intention is to talk about this case and your impression of it. It is a long and winding road. Let's get to phone calls, 617-254-1030, 888-WBZ-1030. Hopefully you've developed a thought or an idea. I can't imagine I guess the only surprise, frankly, was the number of murders that were, quote, not proven, which for all intents and purposes were not guilty verdicts. Jay in the car. Jay, welcome. First tonight, who's a non-guest, but first caller on Nightside. How are you?
You said you don't understand. I think that is the I think Carney explained that in very eloquently in his interviews. The inability of the government to present its case in a format that would prove him guilty in many of those murders. And it, with all due respect to you, to Lana, they're involved. This should have been on TV. I don't understand why the federal government refuses us.
Well. Let me explain that to you then, okay? And first of all, that Jay Carney certainly, as the defense lawyer, is going to say that. All I'm just saying is, I think that the evidence was overwhelming.
Then you're saying that their decision or the time spent by that jury, they made a mistake.
No, what I'm saying is that I didn't sit in that courtroom for the entirety of the trial.
Exactly.
So I'm not going to second guess the jury. All I'm saying is that if you accept the argument that there were 11 people murdered by Bulger, I don't think the government probably threw in an extra 7 just to, just to pile on. But we'll leave that for later conversation. As Scott, the juror told us that the crimes that were the murders, at least, that were not proved were the ones that were further back in the 1970s than more recently. In terms of why cameras aren't in courts, cameras are not in federal courts. There are some federal judges. Former federal judge Nancy Gertner has been an advocate of having cameras in court. And I think that cameras in court would be a plus, and I think that we've used cameras in courts now for an adequately long time, that federal courts could be could still be conducted with the presence of a pool camera. I think, however,
It certainly is a fine line.
Cameras have been used in courts in Massachusetts since the early 1980s.
Yes.
So it's been 30 years, and to the best of my knowledge, there have been no trials in Massachusetts that were disrupted by the presence of cameras in courts, and some of them were pretty high-profile trials, and I think it is long past time for cameras in federal courts, but I do think that many in the judiciary feel that that federal courts are somehow at a higher level, if you will, than mere state courts. I don't agree with that. But that is why I think you will probably we'll still have to wait a while for cameras in federal courts.
Well, I think that I think the evidence the crimes themselves, they preclude the fact that this guy was going to jail for the rest of his life. I mean, the police don't get me wrong.
And, no, I understand that. I still feel sorry for some of the families who tonight do not feel that somehow, some way, the murders of their loved ones have been fully explained. It'll always sort of be an open question. Maybe not in their minds, but at least on the public record.
So for us, it's hearsay. It's who attended the trial. How the evidence was presented, how are we to know? And that's why I said, if cameras were there, perhaps we might have a different decision and a different knowledge of why this.
That's true. Again, I'm an advocate of cameras in courts. Jay, I want to run. I got one more call. I got to get you. Thank you very much. Thanks for getting us going. 617-254-1030, 888-WBZ-1030, looking for your reaction to the end of this saga, at least in terms of Massachusetts. John in Framingham. John, how are you tonight?
Oh, good evening, Dan. How are you?
Doing great. What's your reaction to the Bulger verdicts today?
Well, I feel kind of sorry for the families that with those murder victims who came back unproven. But
yeah.
I had a question for you with respect to, I think you were involved with what's called a New England Innocence Project.
Well, I haven't been directly involved. There's an Innocence Project that deals with individuals who have been convicted of crimes and whose DNA eventually or DNA of someone else proves that they were not involved. And I think so far there's about 250 or so people around the country. I was involved in the Salvati-Lamoni case.
And why I bring this up tonight is there was a guy named Fred Weichel who was...
Fred Weichel.
Yes, Fred Weichel was serving life for what some believe a murder he did not commit.
Yep, I have my serious doubts about that. I've had people on from the Weichel camp, and as a matter of fact, John Conley, the disgraced FBI agent who's now serving a life sentence in Florida for the Callahan murder, potentially... could have provided, I'm told, exculpatory evidence for Weichel, but he was instructed by Woody Bulger not to testify in that case. And I hope that there are some lawyers out there. There have been some very good lawyers, including Jeffrey Denner, who've worked in that case, and others who will continue to look at the case of Fred Weichel.
Yes. The story goes that he was having a beer with John Conley the time the murder.
He wasn't having a beer with Conley, but he says in the place where he was, Conley saw him and Conley recognized him. But we'll leave that one for another night. John, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
Very much now. All
good
right.
night.